Well, we're looking this morning in the book of Proverbs, and I've just re-recorded this for some reason, sort of the first 10 minutes of the service, Ashbourne Baptist this morning, didn't quite record, so I'm just going to record this, just being done at home, so it might sound slightly different, and then we'll try and link it out, the whole sermon's on the website. So, we've looked the last couple of weeks at the woman of wisdom, and we thought in the book of Proverbs, she's this stylized character who's pictured for us as the friend we need, and plays a big part in these first nine chapters, the whole of chapter 8, whole of chapter 9, more or less, and half of chapter 1 is all about this woman of wisdom. There's another woman as well, there's the woman of folly. She has a little bit in end of chapter 9, but we'll do perhaps more about foolishness other times. That will come up more in the book later on. But there's another lady too, a third lady, the woman of immorality. And that's who we're thinking about this morning. The woman of immorality, the danger you must avoid. And in these first nine chapters, almost a third of it is about the danger of immorality. And that's a huge amount of these opening chapters. Whole of chapter 5, whole of chapter 7, and most of chapter 6 as well, dealing with this issue of adultery and immorality. And it's all pictured as this lady, this woman of immorality, I've called her. And perhaps that makes sense in the overall format of the book. All of these chapters begin a father talking to his son, a son who's growing up and is about to sort of head out and make his own path and head out into the big wide world, as it were. And the father is talking to his son and is aware, of course, that his son's bound to take an interest in women. So he pictures this woman of wisdom, this virtuous character, and then he pictures another character, this immoral woman. So she's a fictional character in that sense. She's quite sort of stylized, as we said already, and is a sort of poetical license, perhaps, in the way you talk about these things. It's a lot of stuff in these three chapters. I say it's funny that it talks about it these three times with three separate almost sermons, really. The father sits down, his son, chapter 5, and he wants to talk to him about the dangers of this immoral woman. Then chapter 6, he does the same thing almost the next day, third day. Chapter 7, he sits him down and tells him the third time about this. And so, however uncomfortable we may feel sometimes this morning, thinking about the topic of adultery and so on, I can tell you, at least I'm sparing you three sermons on exactly the same topic, and we're just going to condense it into one. So there's a lot to fit in. And although it's an uncomfortable thing, perhaps is one of those things we wish we didn't have to deal with in quite so much detail that the book of Proverbs does, but it's something that's vitally necessary. It's always been a problem. It's always been a temptation since sin came into this world. In our own culture, going back decades, there were social taboos, perhaps, which kept certain behaviours in check. So adultery and pornography and homosexuality and things like that were seen as social vices. They were seen as things that were harmful to society. And so there was a sort of social taboo about those kind of things. That didn't mean they didn't go on, but they were at least going on very quietly and didn't have the same degree of acceptance or either sort of promotion that we have today in our culture. In 1989, they did a survey of what people thought about morality and various things of that. And then, interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, they repeated the same survey 30 years on. So 30 years ago, 40% of people in this country thought that homosexual relationships were morally wrong. Now that's down to nearer 10%. A mere 10% of people in the country would see there being something wrong with it, something morally wrong with it. Back again 30 years ago, 25% of people thought it was wrong to have a child out of wedlock. Nowadays that's halved, that's down to 13% now. 13% of people think it's wrong to have a child out of wedlock. But, you know, that means a huge 87% of people don't see there being any problem with a mum and dad not being married, or they're not really being a mum or dad, or there being a whole parade of different partners and so on. People 87% of people wouldn't see there being any particular problem with that at all. One stat that stayed about the same is that today 55% of people think infidelity in marriage is wrong. So for a married man or woman to have an affair, to commit adultery, still 55% of people nowadays would say that is morally wrong. Of course, there's a glaring obvious statistic with that too, is 45% of people think that's not. Almost half, isn't it? That's the moral territory we're in at the moment. Big acceptance for lots of these things that would be, the Bible would describe as sexual sins and so on. Big acceptance for that. So now, you know, 45% of people wouldn't think adultery is a big deal. There were various statistics, we won't go into those, on pornography. All sort of embracing nowadays a variety of relationships, homosexual relationships, open relationships where people come and go and so on. All sorts of things. Strip clubs are now fairly commonplace. And those things are welcomed, accepted in society. You know, the number of movies you might see, series on the television, in which characters have one-night stands and affairs and all the rest of it, and that's seen as entirely normal and entirely a fine way to live, a good way to live, and to express themselves and the rest of it. Well, the father wants to warn his young son. Chapter 2, verse 16. He wants to warn his son about the woman who will lead you astray. Again, quite interesting in our modern culture that in the book of Proverbs, this woman is pictured as the predator. And the young boy, the young man, perhaps we should say, the young man comes from a sheltered background, you know, like a Christian home sort of thing. We might call him, in inverted commas, a good boy. And he's a little bit naive, perhaps, a little bit gullible, and he's vulnerable to the likes of a predator, a sexual predator like her. That's strange, isn't it, in our modern society, thinking in that sort of way. So although there is that, of course, temptation comes in all sorts of different ways. So although it's seen in the book of Proverbs as being a very active thing, that there's this predatory character after him, trying to lead him astray, of course, there's lots of other situations. It could be two people finding themselves attracted to each other, but they're both being silly, really, with that temptation, but both wanting that and so on. There can also be the internal nature of temptation. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone who's coming tempting us astray, but of course, the evil desires that come from within and the temptations of Satan can take on a bit of a personality like this character has, like this woman does. Even if it's not someone, there can be those thoughts in our minds enticing us, trying to lead us astray. Nor is it very difficult to turn the whole system round. So here's a father warning his son about the dangers of certain women. And of course, it's not rocket science to turn that round. The same sort of warnings we'd give to a daughter about bewaring of various men and so on. And through all of it, it's our Father who's warning us. So, first thing we notice in these various passages, so we're trying to combine them, is the instruction. So the Father wants to sit down and talk to his son. As we said, he gives him the talk. Perhaps we've all had to do that. Those of us who are parents sit down at some point with our children as they're growing up and give them the talk. We call it about the birds and the bees. I've no idea why. But we want to explain those things to them. And we want to explain to our children the God's plan for sex and marriage. We both want to be positive in that, telling them of the delights, the good things that God has created. But at the same time, we want to tell them about the dangers. Are we doing that as parents? Are we being honest with our children about the dangers that they will face out there in society and in their own hearts and minds? And that's how it all begins, for instance, chapter 6 and verse 20. My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart, tie them round your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you wake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the law is a light. The father wants to talk to his son and instruct him in these ways. And he can say, me and your mother, the father and mother have both been obedient parents in passing on these instructions of God. And so he can almost combine those things, The language, of course, of Proverbs 6 is very much like Deuteronomy 6, where God talks to the Israelites the same sort of way about binding his commandments around their necks and so on, having them near to their heart, speaking to them about these things. That's how God talked about his commandments in Deuteronomy 6. And in Proverbs 6, the Father talks about his commandments, which are the same as God's commandments. He's truthfully passing on God's instructions to his son. Are we doing that as parents? Vital thing for us to think about. Because here the Creator gives us his instructions. He gives us guidance for life. And we mustn't leave these things to school. School will, in children's personal, social, health, education sort of curriculum, deal with sex education. But they're going to approach it from a completely different approach to the Bible. There's loads of stuff on that situation in Christian Institute and various other newsletters we can get. But we as parents need to be taking the initiative. This is not the world's message. This is God's message that we need to impart to our children, both about the delights and the dangers of all that God has created for us. And we need to make that our way of life. Chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commandments and live. And my law is the apple of your eye. Encouraging that right way of living, for God's commandments bring life. Secondly, in these chapters, we find the warning. Chapter 2 and verse 16, for example. He's writing these things to deliver you from the immoral woman, literally to save you. The father, with great earnestness, talks to his son, I want to save you. And of course, the flip side of the coin is, if you don't listen to this, it'll destroy you. That's the warning. Really strong. It's going to be strong language in these chapters, because the immoral woman will destroy you. The temptation to adultery, to sex outside of marriage, sex before marriage, whatever, it'll destroy you, he says. Same in chapter 6, verse 24. He's writing these things to keep you from the evil woman. And it's the same phrase in chapter 7, verse 5 as well, to keep you from the immoral woman. I want to keep you safe. We as parents want that, don't we? We want to keep our children safe. And that, this is part of what he's passing on. I need to keep you safe from her, from this temptation. And so he tells him about it. And he's going to do it in a slightly different way to that which the law would. So in the commandments, you of course have, thou shalt not commit adultery. But the book of Proverbs is going to approach it in a slightly different way to that, which will reinforce that message for us. Hopefully we can continue with the rest of the sermon that was recorded in church this morning. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And the law just tells us it's a sin. It's wrong. It's immoral. The wisdom books sort of work parallel to that. And in these books, like the book of Proverbs, he approaches it from a different angle. He doesn't actually often tell us, thou shalt not commit adultery, like the law says, because it's a sin. He'll tell us, don't do it because it's not wise. And those two things are sort of parallel strands, aren't they? It can, of course, be both of those things. It can be a sin, and it can also be unwise. And wisdom is going to think, the wisdom books are going to think about the practical implications of it. And the wisdom books will broaden it out as well. Because just the bare bones of the commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, in the book of Proverbs here, he'll tell you how you can kind of avoid being in the situation in the first place. That's wisdom. That's how wisdom plays its parallel role to that. For instance, chapter 5 and verse 7. Therefore, hear me now, my children. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Verse 8. Remove your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house. Wisdom will tell you how to avoid this situation in the first place. Here, same in chapter 7 that we were reading, and verse 25. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. It's about protecting our hearts, being careful where we go. People we need to avoid. Places we should avoid. The red light district. Dodgy shops. Inappropriate websites. Dubious emails. You know the stuff that we need to avoid. The book of Proverbs wants us to think about those who've gone before. Chapter 7, verse 26. She has cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. This is wisdom literature. He's telling us, think about just examples of what has happened. Think about those who've met disaster. Perhaps the one who comes most to mind is Samson, isn't it? The strong man who is defeated by his lusts, who is defeated by not being able, with all his strength, to resist an immoral woman. Think about those who've met disaster before. That's what wisdom is doing. He's warning us in a slightly different way to that the law would do. Thirdly, he thinks very detailedly about the temptation itself. As we said, he's warning us about us in the first instance. Part of it is protecting ourselves. It was there in chapter 7, wasn't it? The writer of Proverbs says, I looked through the window and looked through the lattice, and I saw among the simple, among the youths, a man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. He took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. The temptation was there because he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. This young man is being naive. He's gullible. He's simple. He's not talking about his GCSE levels or anything like that. He's saying he's not thinking about the danger. He hasn't got his wise hat on, as it were. He's not thinking about God's ways. He's just idly walking up and down, verse 8, near her corner. He knows who's around there. He's hanging out in the dubious part of town. He's there. He's seen this lady before, and so he's just wandering around with nothing particularly on his mind by her house. He's doing it in the evening, at twilight, in the black and dark night. Of course, a picture of sin and temptation. He's playing with fire, we'd say. He's playing around with temptation, seeing almost how close the moth can get to the flame without being burnt. He's naive. He's an idiot, isn't he? And so much of the temptations we face, aren't they the same? Aren't they because we're being an idiot? Aren't they because we're being naive and not realising the dangers we're putting ourselves in? And then there's her, the temptress, in many ways. We've thought a little bit about the way the words work before. Chapter 2, verse 16, it talks about the seductress who flatters with her words. And in chapter 5, verse 3, he pictures it in this way. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, her mouth is smoother than oil. He thinks about the temptation, it's all lies. It's flattery. She has words like honey and oil. Sweet. They sound nice. They are appealing to us. They're smooth. That's the situation we're facing, the temptation that comes along. Chapter 7, verse 10, there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. We might say she's dressed to kill. She's dressed to tempt. That would be more true. She's not a harlot. She talks about her husband later on. But she's dressed like one. She's dressed to tempt, to lead him astray. There's her beauty, chapter 6, verse 24. To keep you from the immoral woman, from the flattering tongue of the seductress, do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. She has a certain beauty to her. Do not let her allure you, lead you astray. And be careful how you think about it in your heart. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart. That's somebody again, this naive man who's just thinking about her, daydreaming of her. Think about it in his mind. The temptation is growing. It's growing. It's getting stronger. There's temptation there because he's playing around in his mind before anything's happened, as it were. But Jesus, of course, would tell us, wouldn't he, in the Sermon on the Mount, it's not just those who physically commit adultery, but whoever lusts. That's what he's doing here, isn't he? In his mind. There she is. Back in chapter 7, where it's got probably most of the temptation, and he pitches it in various ways. Chapter 7, verse 11, she's loud and rebellious, her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. She caught him and kissed him. There she is, she's on the prowl, we might say. She's there, loitering around, looking for someone. And then he's the one she catches. She's brazen, unashamed. Chapter 7 and verse 19, she talks about her husband. Open about that. My husband's not at home. He's gone on a long journey. She's open about her immorality. She's cheating on her husband. She thinks she's got plenty of time before he comes home. And so on. It's all about the senses. Verse 16 talks about the bed. Spread with silks and Egyptian linen and perfumes and all these spices and so on. It's about the feel, the sheets, the smell of the perfume and the like. It's all very sensual, isn't it? And those things then are those things we begin to think about. Not thinking with our brain in gear, but thinking about the senses. Thinking about what would make us fulfilled. The temptation is growing stronger. And then there's a false promise, isn't there? Verse 18, come let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. There's going to be delight. There's going to be enjoyment. We're going to experience love. And there's going to be no repercussions. Verse 19 and 20, my husband's gone away. You know, this is no strings attached. No consequences to our actions. There's the temptation. And it is a real one, isn't it? It's a real temptation. The things she's talking about are tempting. They are working on this man, aren't they? He's falling for it. Hook, line and sinker, we might say. He's been reeled in like a fisherman catching a fish. That's what temptation is, isn't it? It's a bit of bait on a hook. There's something about it that captivates our senses, that appeals to our hearts. And so it is, these temptations to sexual sin. They are tempting. They are appealing to our bodies, to the way we're wired, to the way our minds so easily wander. To our senses, to our longings, to our needs, we might say. And yet, the one thing she won't talk about is, fourthly, the reality. The reality of those things. So as we said already, it's all flattery and lies. It's all flattery and lies, isn't it? Chapter 5, verse 3, her lips drip honey, her mouth is smoother than oil. Verse 4, but in the end she's bitter as wormwood, poison, sharp as a two-edged sword. That's what it's like. That's the reality of it. They're lies. It's all sweetness. It's all appealing, tempting things, tempting words and so on. But it's poisonous. It initially feels like honey. Tastes like that on the lips. But it's poison. And it goes down into our body. It feels so smooth and sensual like oil. But it stabs like a sword. Gets to our heart. That's what it's like. And you can't believe a word she says. Chapter 2, verse 17, talks about the immoral woman in verse 16, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. She can't be trusted.
Why would you trust the word she says to you? Chapter 2, verse 17, she's already been somebody who's forsaken somebody else. Why would you believe her? Why would you listen to what she says? Same in chapter 7, where she talks about her husband who's gone away on a work journey. You can't trust her. And yet the way she manipulates, the way she uses her words. We were told in chapter 7 that she's lurking around, verse 12, outside in the open square, lurking at every corner. And then when she finds this young man, she tells him, I've been looking for you, end of verse 15. She makes him feel special. She said, oh, I've been longing for you. It's not that at all. She's after anyone. She's after anyone. And so it's the lies of it. It makes him feel special. But it's all manipulation. It's all flattery, isn't it? She promises love. Verse 18, still in chapter 7. But all it will be is a brief moment of lust. She pretends there'll be no consequences. Her husband's gone far away. You know, we've got nothing to worry about. And yet the reality is a defeat. It's there in verse 21. With enticing speech she caused him to yield. With flattering lips she seduced him. He's been defeated by her words. Fifthly, we find the consequences. The consequences of it. As we said, Proverbs will talk less about... We'll talk a little bit about it, but it doesn't just stick with what the law says, that immorality is a sin, but it will talk about the effects of immorality, how dangerous it all is. Chapter 5, verse 9, it's about this immoral woman. It says, lest you give your honour to others and your years to the cruel one. He talks in those verses about the consequences. The first one is you'll lose respect. You'll give your honour away. You'll no longer be an honourable person. You'll no longer be respected by others. You'll be despised when people find out what you've done. Same in chapter 6 and verse 30. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he's starving. Don't despise somebody who's broken the law because they deemed it necessary. Somebody who was starving and stole. People don't despise him. But people do despise somebody who sins stupidly. Who sin for no real reason. That is something people despise. For that sort of thing. It leaves you vulnerable. A little bit hard. Chapter 5 verse 9. He talks about do not give your honour to others. And your years to the cruel one. A little bit strange. Perhaps wondering what that might be. Lest aliens are filled with your wealth. And your labours go to the house of a foreigner. It might be talking about being vulnerable. Being vulnerable to blackmail. How many stories of that have there been? Some politician, some celebrity who committed adultery and it was all a trap. And then they're vulnerable then to blackmail and the like. And there's no way out. But they never thought through all the implications of things. They're vulnerable too. Chapter 6, verse 34. For jealousy is a husband's fury. He will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be pleased, though you give him many gifts. You're vulnerable to fury, to jealousy. One of the leading causes of murder, isn't it? Adultery. That somebody's adultery then led to murder. One sin leads to another. That's the way Proverbs will tell us. It'll tell us about the consequences of actions, the implications of things, in all sorts of different ways. We'll lose money, perhaps it might be. You have to bribe, pay off the blackmailer. You have to try and make some sort of recompense for something. Chapter 5, verse 10, all your labours go to the house of a foreigner, lest aliens be filled with your wealth. It might be that he's talking about a little bit hard in some of this poetry. To always know that. Perhaps the same sort of thing in chapter 6, verse 26. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. There are those who've headed into this lifestyle, and whether it's through the fees of paying for prostitutes, you know, the upkeep of a mistress or whatever it is. And by all of these things, he's reduced to absolute poverty, he says, in those things. Maybe the body, too, that's damaged. Chapter 5, verse 11. Sorry, having to jump around a little bit. And you mourn at last when your flesh and body are consumed. Is that a warning of 3,000 years ago about the dangers of STDs? Infections that come from immorality and adultery? The AIDS epidemic that would come later on? Is it a warning about the same sort of thing there? The way the body is damaged by not living in God's ways. Chapter 5 and verse 12, sticking with that one. And you say, how I hated instruction and despised correction. I did not obey the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. And somebody who's now filled with despair and regret, guilt and loathing at the things they've done. Proverbs wants to tell us about the consequences of those things. People laugh, don't they? People laugh at God's commands. But the consequences are plain to see, aren't they? There's a logic, isn't there? We've talked about that before in the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is telling us about the logic of God's ways. That God's ways are the best ways because the ways of sin are awful. The consequences of sin are there on the surface. People in our society, however much they may embrace homosexuality and infidelity and broken homes and all this stuff and say, oh, it's no big deal. Families come in all shapes and sizes. Everything's fine. We need to embrace all these different sorts of lifestyles. But the facts are plain to see. There's a logic to live in God's ways. And the consequences are there for us. But as well as all of those practical things that may happen, one of his points to chapter 5, verse 21, for the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. All of these things are seen by God. This woman in chapter 7, she thought she wouldn't get caught. She finds this young man, says, oh, we'll be fine. We can go home, we can enjoy ourselves. We'll never be caught. There'll be no consequences. But everything is seen by God. Wasn't it the same very situation that David fell into? David, the one who was led astray into this very sin of adultery, even after walking with God, even after being happily married and so on. And he did it, he covered it all up, thought it was all fine. And yet he has to be come and told later on, doesn't he, by the prophet Nathan, you've been seen by God. Everything is known by him. Chapter 5, verse 22. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. Sin brings slavery. People thought the years of the 60s and 70s and sexual liberation people talked about. Freedom from all these shackles of the Victorian era. Now we're free to enjoy ourselves. People talk about sexual freedom, but it's sexual slavery. People talk about being liberated from society's regulations and taboos, but it's addictive. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man. It's addictive. It's impossible to escape. This is the sins that are slavery. And chapter 5, verse 23, it leads to death. He shall die for a lack of instruction. In the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray. And there's so much of that, isn't there, in the book of Proverbs? Proverbs 2, verse 18, her house leads to death, her path to the dead. None who go to her return, nor do they regain the ways of life. Same in chapter 7, verse 22. It's just sort of piling it on, isn't it, these warnings for us. 7, verse 22, immediately he went after her, as an ox to the slaughter, as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver and a bird hastens to the snare. He did not know that it would cost him his life. Chapter 6, verse 32, whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Chapter 7, verse 27, her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. Strong stuff, isn't it? warning us that that is the wages of sin. That's what this adulterous woman gives. She promises love, she gives death. That's what temptation gives us, isn't it? Temptation promises us pleasure and enjoyment and the like. But it brings us death. It brings us slavery to sin. It addicts us. It traps us. It will take us to hell. Proverbs is strong, isn't it, on the consequences. He's not saying, of course, that sexual sins are unforgivable. He's not saying there's no forgiveness, there's no way back. Of course, there's the story of people like David. There's the verses, isn't there, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9. He talks about that church there that seems to have been in a place like Corinth, full of sexual problems and people not living in God's ways. He talks there about that no adulterer, no homosexual will be there in heaven. But you've been saved, you've been washed, you've been forgiven. That's what he says in 1 Corinthians 6, isn't it? There is forgiveness. There is salvation for even these sins. But his point here in Proverbs is don't go there in the first place. He's warning his young son to stay away from those places. And he's saying on that pathway, there is no life. There is no life, there is no salvation while we're going down that path and continuing to unrepentantly walk on that path. We need to turn away, don't we, from those sins. Lastly then, there's the alternative. For the book of Proverbs is strong, isn't he, on all of those dangers. But he also tells us about the good things that God's given to us to enjoy. Only God can create something good. The world may think it invented sex, but it didn't. The world can't create things that are good. The devil can't create something good. Only God can do that. The good things in this world come from him. Love, satisfaction, enjoyment, freedom, those things come from God, not from the temptations of Satan. People think they'll have love and satisfaction in an affair, in an adultery, in one night stand, in pornography, all those sorts of things. But it's a lie. It's the way the devil twists things. He can take something good and twist it, so it only brings hurt. And that's what God gives us, something good. Here in chapter 5 and verse 15, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Talks about marriage. It's a picture in the land of Israel, of course. The most important thing was water. People longed for water, a clean, bubbling fountain of living water. That's what marriage is like, he says. Drink water from your own cistern. Enjoy your own marriage, is his point. All that adultery is promising you is a little dirty trickle down the gutter. Chapter 5, verse 16. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and not for strangers. Rather than this bubbling fountain of water that God gives in his good gifts, why instead are you getting a muddy trickle out of the gutter of the streets? God's given marriage. Chapter 5, verse 18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. A loving deer, a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and be enraptured with her love. Why should you, my son, be enraptured by a moral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? He talks about the good things that God gives. God's given gift of marriage. A man and a woman married for life with love and commitment, faithfulness and security. Satisfaction and enjoyment that can be found there. That's God's good gift. The father wants to encourage his son to think of that, to long for that, to wait for that gift from God, not to go after all of these other things instead. And so there is these chapters for us that we've had to move through very swiftly. It's taken a little bit too long, but I hope there's something there for us to think about. Necessary warning As difficult as it might be to preach and to hear, are still those things we need to think about, don't we? Those warnings we need to take to heart, these words of life that God gives to us.